Court will proceed to the second case, also Gary versus Secretary Venable.
Please report, my name is John Vetney. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Alto Dairy, et al. In this case. There are two issues on appeal. I'd like to address my comment first, if the court will allow, to the second issue, that of adequacy of notice of the rule that was eventually published by USDA in June of last year.
You want to skip standing?
Yeah. I want to address standing. Counsel for Continental is taking 5 minutes of my time to address exclusively standing, and I believe she will do a good job. And she's on the other side on the notice issue, so I want to focus my comments initially on notice issue. Notice issues most frequently come up in the D.C. Circuit, and this court has referred to decisions of the D.C. Circuit for guidance, most notably Fertilizer Institute, but I will look initially to...
If your clients were unsophisticated people, it would be one thing, but they're sophisticated. They knew, you know, there's this kind of, you know, what it's called, a scandal or a loophole or something that the Department of Agriculture would try to close in one way or the other. So you knew, you knew you had to participate, otherwise you might lose your paper pooling benefits. So,
I believe that is untrue for two reasons, Judge Posner. One is that the agency is obligated to give notice, and this is referred to on page 33 of my opening case.
Notice is so that people can, know whether to participate.
So that the non-experts.
Your people knew they had to participate because the Department of Agriculture was going to try to close this loophole. That was the whole purpose of the proceeding.
That was not...
If they close the loophole, they're going to squeeze you.
If I can try to explain the loophole and its context in here, because American Medical enunciates a principle that I think is a good one, and that is adequacy of notice.
Yes, I know, but that's just a general principle. That's not going to decide the case.
Close examination of the facts in the particular proceeding, and that's what I want to do. The facts in this particular proceeding is that there was no notice published by USDA of a loophole.
You're not meeting the point. Everyone knew there was this tremendous loophole, right? Your clients are, if I understand, maybe I don't get the facts because I've never heard of this milk marketing order business before. As I understand it, your clients, put it crudely, they're selling their milk to make cheese in Wisconsin.
True.
But they're getting the benefit of prices paid for drinking milk in other states. And so they're taking advantage of, all sorts of fiction. They're not, most of their milk is being sold in Wisconsin, not in these eastern states, and it's being sold for cheese rather than milk, but they're somehow getting revenues based on milk sales in the east. So that was perceived as a loophole, and this purpose of this administrative proceeding was to close the loophole. And of course, there were many different ways in which it could be closed. And your complaint is you weren't notified as to the particular way in which it turned out that they closed it. Isn't that what the case is about, or am I missing?
I do not believe so, and I do believe Your Honor is missing something.
Okay.
What is missing, Your Honor, is first of all, is the perception that the loophole is a loophole that applies to Wisconsin, and it doesn't apply elsewhere. The identical method of pooling a cheese plant and using most of the milk or all of the milk for cheese applies in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana. That loophole whereby a cheese plant, for example, near Muskegon, Michigan, supply plant where there is one, can pool its supply of farmers near the plant and qualify on the basis of farms located near Pittsburgh or Detroit or West Virginia, that loophole exists, continues to exist for those plants. The paper pooling, if that word is to be used to describe that function, is the function that applied both in and out of the market. The final rule that was adopted, proposed and effected, an elimination of paper pooling, to use the court's use of that term, for out-of-area cheese supply plants, but not for in-area cheese supply plants. Secondly, the notice itself...
So what? I don't get that.
Okay. The notice itself contained nothing about differential treatment of in-area versus out-of-area farms and suppliers. There were, the context of the fact of this case is that there was a proceeding immediately prior June in Minneapolis and subsequently in the spring in St. Louis in which specific proposals were made to differentiate in-area versus out-of-area participants in the market and have different rules apply. Nothing like that came in this proposal.
Well, as I understand, I don't know, I don't think the briefs really explain this adequately at all, what's going on. But as I understand it, the Agriculture Department's rule is that your clients actually have to ship, 30% of their milk into the East in order to get the benefit of that Eastern price. Is that correct?
That 30% of the milk was and is the standard, I believe.
And
yeah.
Before, you only had to ship 3%.
I see your point. The rule now is that 30% of the milk has to come from the plant in Wisconsin.
Right.
And the rule is that 3% of the milk has to come from a competitor plant located in Muskegon. That's the current rule. That's the rule we're contesting, and that's the rule that was not noticed.
What do you feel was noticed? Let's assume, arguendo, it could have been more specific.
It could have been more specific, and in fact, it was more specific.
How is it misleading versus similar rules, and for example, the notices that were issued in those other jurisdictions that you just mentioned?
As a matter of fact, 4 days prior to this hearing, a notice was issued for the central market, which was held in St. Louis, in which language precisely, using precisely the words that we contest here, was included with the notice of hearing. The department, of course, was aware of that before the hearing was commenced. The intervener defendants were aware of that because it was their proposal. It was not included in this notice. In 1981, Your Honor, there was a hearing in the Tennessee Valley market in which the method by which milk moves from a farm to a bottling plant was at issue. And the proponent there, which was a cheese plant, Kraft cheese plant, asked that part of the milk be allowed to be moved directly from farms to the customer. The example given in the Federal Register, when the Secretary adopted this, was one of the farms is only located 3 miles from the customer plant. And the way the rules currently read now is that farm has to go back to the distributing plant or the supply cheese plant, be unloaded, be reloaded, and then moved to the distributing plant.
Well, I don't understand. What does that have to do? I don't get the connection. I don't understand that business. I thought their concern was about you're taking advantage of a price for drinking milk in the East, you know, with a lot of urban consumers and so on of milk, when actually what you're doing is selling this milk for cheese in Wisconsin. I thought that was the concern. Isn't that the concern?
That is not... I do not believe that is the regulated concern. That is the concern of the proponents. But USDA has...
What sense does that make? Why should you, if you're selling this milk for cheese in Wisconsin, why should you be getting a price based on the consumption of milk for drinking in New York?
Oh, this is not New York.
What's the sense of that?
But in fact, there's a plant in Salt Lake City that's regulated in New England, for example.
Maybe it's shipping its milk to New England, but you're not shipping your milk to New England. You're shipping it to Wisconsin.
Yes. As a matter of fact...
So why are you getting a price that's a price for a different use of milk in a different part of the country?
Because the statute specifically says that producers are entitled to a uniform price regardless of use. So the fact that some producers...
regardless of where the milk is going to.
And, well, regardless of where the milk...
You're exploiting a loophole. If your customer's milk is not being drunk, it's being made into cheese, because there aren't that many people in Wisconsin.
And some of it is being drunk, and
some of it, not as much as in the East, where they don't have as much cheese manufacturing.
And 30% of my client's milk supply, just like 30% of the Michigan supply, cheese plant milk supply, was shipped to distributing plants. That is a rule that was at issue, and it could have been increased or decreased across the board, same as everybody else. There was a modest change during the hearing, but that modest change during the hearing would not have required my clients to deteriorate the quality of their milk by pumping it into a plant and back out.
I don't see what quality has to do with it.
Quality has to do with it because USDA has said it is bad economic policy.
Your customers are in Wisconsin, aren't they? Why don't you ship the milk to the cheese plant in Wisconsin? The only reason to ship it to a supply plant is you want to take advantage of this price in the East.
Oh, absolutely. Market value...
You should be permitted to do that, of course.
And that's what USDA has said, is that blend prices from market to market, as a matter of policy, is what should decide when producers and supply organizations decide to market their milk in market A or market B. That comes out of the 1993 national hearing decision, which was challenged in the Minnesota Milk Producers case and involved two subsequent clarifying decisions by USDA. There has never been a policy, nor do I believe there could be, in view of the trade barrier provision of the Act, that says rules can or should be structured to prevent producers and producer groups from outside or even far outside of a market from associating with that market.
Associating with that market? What does that mean? It's not, you're not selling this stuff in the East. You're just taking advantage of a... You're selling 3% of your milk in the East, but you're taking this association business, you're taking advantage of a price in the East, which doesn't reflect your actual market. I thought that's what the Agriculture Department was trying to stop.
I think what the Agriculture Department will explain they were trying to do is to require performance, that is, require shipments. And what they required in the final rule was not of the nature that they required or would have required, nor did USDA actually publish in its proposal anything about this. They could have. They had the opportunity to publish. They relied on DFA.
What did you think they were going to do?
Well, you know, I wasn't there because
well,
there wasn't.
Wasn't very helpful.
It wasn't because there was no rule for differential treatment. I represented clients in Minneapolis. I represented them in St. Louis where there was differential treatment proposed. Here, we had no opportunity to comment, particularly on this unload, pump in, pump out.
What did you think was going to come out of this proceeding?
Something along the lines of that which was proposed. It may have been more or less of the same category, but just as in the pricing case that I referred to in the brief...
What was proposed wouldn't have harmed your clients at all?
What was proposed, in some respects, would have made it more difficult, but it wouldn't harm them in the same way, in the same degree, and it wouldn't provide discriminatory treatment. And we could not have consulted experts, we could not have put on expert testimony, we could not have asked USDA to prepare statistical data that responds to this proposal, as we always do, because it didn't come out before the hearing, it didn't come out during the hearing, it came out in the final decision when our only opportunity to present evidence and facts was not a notice and comment, but on a hearing that lasted about 2 days.
Mr. Bentley, when you did, were aware of a notice that says amend certain pooling and related provisions of the Mideast order, that's got to be troubling at least, right? I mean, it may not be exactly what ahead, but it isn't. It had to pique the interest, would you think?
Well, my interest would be piqued, Your Honor, on the basis of my experience. And my experience with pooling provisions, as I explained in the Tennessee Valley, is where the method by which milk is pooled, USDA ruled that the quantity was beyond the scope of the hearing. And another case where the quantity was at issue, USDA ruled that the method by which pump in, pump out. When prices were at issue in Michigan for pricing protein and butter fat to change from the volume, the proposal was for components of protein and butter fat to be priced. The proposal was made, let's price the other solids too. USDA ruled, even though it was the same section of the order, the same concept, the same issue, that other solids were not in the scope of the hearing. That is my reference, and that is the reference of those that are experts, because that's the way it's been done. We have one shot, a hearing, a formal hearing, at which there's cross-examination, opportunity to present experts and witnesses, to present those facts.
Is there a procedure, and I, like this prisoner, relatively new to the area, though I come from born in dairy country and now return to it, but if a notice like this comes out, is there a way of inquiry can be made of the Secretary?
Your Honor, the notice comes out, I see my time's up, my rebuttal time. The way the notice comes, there's a notice issued, proposal is issued. USDA then releases, if it thinks it might go to hearing, an invitation to submit additional proposals, so that the proposal that's advanced by somebody is released, at least within the industry, and others are given an opportunity to present similar proposals, or new proposals, or add additional proposals. The Secretary then winnows this down, sometimes rejects proposals out of hand, and publishes all those proposals that the Secretary would like to have heard. Once, and up to that point, there's some discussion with the agency. From that point on, there is not. And that fixes the focus of the hearing, and that fixes the party's focus for
expert. So you're saying you were surprised?
I was surprised, my clients were surprised.
When you were surprised, did you say to the Department of Agriculture, we've been surprised, so we need some more time to submit evidence?
Actually, the surprise came when it was too late. It came in the final decision.
It came too late. All right, so did you ask them to reconsider and, you know, give you more time because you've been surprised?
There was no reconsideration. The only opportunity...
Did you ask them for reconsideration?
Only in this lawsuit, which came like 2 days after the rule became effective.
Why didn't you ask them? Why'd you sue before asking them, saying you'd been surprised and you wanted some opportunity to present evidence?
Well, I can say I talked to them and I talked to other parties, but the rule became effective August 1. There was no time for...
Do they have a procedure for reconsideration?
They have a procedure. There is no procedure for reconsideration. There is a procedure for comment on proposed rules that haven't taken effect, and in this case, it was sort of a mixture in which this rule was made effective, but USDA said it's receptive to comments. Comments were submitted last fall. It hasn't responded to the comments in the form of a final rule yet. The procedure normally is, as it was in New York last summer, or last fall, if there's a proposal, if something else comes up, as it did, obviously, because the ALCO and DFA knew, if something else comes up...
I don't see why you didn't tell them. You've been surprised. You wanted it reopened.
Well, our surprise came in June and July when the decision came out. That's when, for the first
that's
time.
That's when you were surprised. So why did you say to them, you know, we've been surprised? You should give
there's
us more
there's no procedural opportunity at
oh,
that point.
Oh, every agency, every court has inherent power to reconsider a decision within a reasonable time. You can always ask them to do that, rather than ask us to tell them.
I'll give you some time, Mr. Bettany, for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Ms. Reed?
Thank you, Your Honor, and thank you, Mr. Bettany, for allowing us to step in a little bit of his time this morning to address the issue of standing. My name is Christine Reed, and I'm here on behalf of Continental Dairy Products. While Continental agrees with the district court's analysis on the merits of the appellant's producer's claims, we do disagree with the decision that dairy producers, through their cooperative organizations, are without standing to challenge the administrative process and the terms of the marketing order. There are several reasons why my clients as dairy producers believe that it's critical that a producer has a right to judicial review to challenge the Secretary's actions. In the first instance, Your Honor, there's no administrative remedy provided for producers under 608C15, and judicial review is sometimes the only available forum for a producer. And in many instances, without it, review may never occur because often handlers do not have the same incentives to challenge agency action that the producers do.
Well, what about in this case?
Yeah, in this case, that's exactly the situation, Your Honor. In the first instance, the thrust of the producer's arguments really at this point, as you've just heard from the discussion on the merits, is more of a procedural challenge, and that is that they're claiming that the Secretary's notice of the proposed rulemaking and hearing was legally insufficient. And this is important in several respects. Critically, is that this is a question of first impression in this court to discuss producer standing when it comes to this type of a procedural challenge. The district court noticed this and pointed this out in footnote 4 of its opinion, recognizing that to preclude producers of judicial review when the challenge is the adequacy of the procedural requirements would seem to be at odds, in fact, with the purposes of the AMAA, the underlying statute here. And this is because the statutory scheme is designed to protect the producers. And within that statutory scheme are provisions and procedures which the Secretary must follow, including these notice provisions and opportunities to be heard. And these are all specifically designed to involve the producers. And to get back to your question about why handlers just simply do not...
I don't even know what handlers are. I couldn't figure that out either from the briefs. So what are handlers?
Handlers are the plants that we've been discussing, that were discussed earlier. My client...
What plants?
Like cheese plants, manufacturing plants, ice cream plants. Okay,
supply plants?
I don't believe so.
I thought there were two different. I thought there were the supply plants, which were intermediate between the farmers and the distributors.
Perhaps generally I can help with that, with your concerns, and saying that generally speaking, a handler's interest tends to be aligned with a consumer's interest, okay? And that was pointed out in the community nutrition case, which really discussed, consumer issues and consumers' right to challenge.
Well, if a handler is a cheese factory or whatever you call it, why would that be aligned with consumers? I don't get that.
The alignment is in the objective of keeping prices low.
I thought it was a processor as opposed to a handler.
manufacturing. Isn't the handler the middle person that transports and ships it around?
Yes. Yes, that's probably a better way of putting it.
Five cows. We didn't much of it.
He didn't have many of these issues.
So all this is very...
It's a complex scheme. There's no question about that.
But I thought that we had an expert on this panel.
Gotcha.
The five cow judge. It looks like him. But those are... The handler is in the middle.
I think that's a fair statement. I guess the bigger picture of where it matters in terms of standing, though, is that the producers, the AMAA is designed primarily to protect the producers, okay? And like I was mentioning, the alignment has traditionally been that handlers have a closer alignment to consumers of keeping prices low, whereas the goal of the underlying statute is to protect producer prices. And
I have a real problem on the handler having a closer identification with consumer versus producer. I mean, maybe I'm just missing the economics of this, but
if I can take it a little more specifically, I guess maybe in this case, is that the producers are challenging their right to participate in this producer settlement fund of this order by challenging the definitions that say, you know, who is entitled to participate. The plants don't have the same interest in the first instance because they don't share in the proceeds of the pool, okay, and therefore don't have the incentive to bring an administrative challenge. If the producers are successful in their claim on the merits, for instance, in this case, the result is that the pool is diluted by the addition of other producers, and how that affects a plant is that they have to pay more potentially to attract milk to their plant. There certainly is a distinction in whether the producers, at least the incentives are different between the producers and other parties.
Thank you, Ms. Ridge. All right. Mr. Clare?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May I please the Court, I'm Jeffrey Clare. I'm Justice Department Counsel for the Secretary of Agriculture, the appellee in this case. Let me turn first, if I might, to the threshold question of whether the claims pressed by plaintiffs were properly before the Court. This has been characterized as a standing question, a jurisdictional question. I'm not sure that those terms are quite appropriate, but there is a question of whether the handlers have a right to bring these claims before the district court, I'm sorry, whether the plaintiffs have a right to bring these claims before the district court, whether they have a cause of action to properly invoke the court's jurisdiction. One thing that is clear in the briefs, and I think agreed by all the parties, is what, if there is any such right, it does not emanate from the marketing order statute itself. That statute, its subsection 7 U.S.C. 608C, 15, which is quoted in the briefs and appended to the Secretary's brief, gives the right for handlers to petition the Secretary.
There's a presumption of judicial reviewability of agency actions that aggrieve a party. So the producer is clearly the ones affected here rather than the handlers. So what's the argument against the producers having being able to sue?
The argument, Your Honor, is that the presumption emanates in part from statutes that are ordinarily construed to confer a right of review and
like the APA,
exactly. And this is the focus of the Supreme Court's analysis of this question with respect to the statute and the community.
Well, no, that was about consumer standing, but different. But I don't understand what the argument is against allowing these producers to sue, since they're the one whose ox is gored by these rules.
Well, there are several points that are similar to the points the Supreme Court made in addressing consumer standing, Your Honor. First, the statute gives note the pertinent statute to which the APA directs the court to consider.
Yeah, but a reason, not a...
Oh, a reason. Well, Your Honor, the marketing orders issued under this statute principally regulate Sandler's. It was a Depression-era statute that was intended to shore up minimum prices for milk. It does not preclude a farmer or producer from charging more than that amount. It does, however, impose potentially civil penalties on handlers who don't comply with the terms of the order. They are the ones that suffer. They are regulated by the order. They are the ones
that
suffer.
But the handlers don't care particularly about this order. This order just harms these Wisconsin farmers by depriving them of, you know, this higher price that they could get if by this phony association business. So they're the ones who are hurt. Why shouldn't they sue?
Well, Your Honor, the
handlers aren't going to sue.
Your Honor, let me first point out that many of the plaintiffs in this case are dairy cooperatives and all the members are either dairy cooperatives or individual members of a dairy cooperative. By the Secretary's regulation, a dairy cooperative is a handler and has the right to an...
No, but you're talking now about a dual... You're talking about a company or a co-op or something like that, which has a farmer's side and a handler's side.
That would include all these plaintiffs.
It's the farmer's side that's being gored. So if you had a producer who didn't have this affiliation with a handler, with a cheese factory or something, that person, on your view, couldn't sue, even though that's the person being hurt.
Well, that's
so
true.
So what's the purpose of that?
Well, Your Honor, that's true. That would be a harder case than this one, because...
I don't understand you. What you're saying is, yes, of course, if they were just producers here, we'd have to let them sue. But by an accident, some of them have affiliation with handlers. Handlers are mentioned in the statute. Therefore, they should be able to sue. But they're not suing as handlers, even if they have a handler affiliation. It says producers that they're being hurt, so why shouldn't they be allowed to sue as producers?
Your Honor, because Congress did not provide...
No, that's your wooden statutory argument that there just isn't a provision in this agricultural act. But you have a reason, something that would appeal to a practical person. Why, of all the people who are adversely affected by administrative action in the United States, these people should not be allowed to sue.
Well, Your Honor, it's important to note that what they're asking is the right to sue directly without invoking any administrative process, so that these disputes do not get channeled to the Secretary. There is no opportunity for the Secretary to apply his or her considerable historical...
Well, I don't understand. They were parties. They were parties to the proceedings.
They were parties who could have qualified as handlers, who could have invoked these...
handlers. As producers, they participated in the... or they should have participated, and they argue they didn't get those. But the point is, they go to the agency first, and they challenge the agency's... Are you saying there's another route of statutory... of judicial review that they should be in a court of appeals, or what?
I'm saying that the plaintiffs in this case had access to administrative and judicial review.
But do they have an alternative route to get judicial review?
Not for the claims that are presented here.
Well, that's the problem, you have to give me, at least, some reason to think that there is some sense in excluding them from all judicial remedies.
And, well, Your Honor, the place to look for that sense is in the statutory scheme itself. Congress has created a statute that regulates handlers, that imposes restrictions on handler conduct, not producer conduct. Congress has created a statutory scheme that gives farmers, producers, a right to participate in the administrative process, but is wholly silent with respect to any right.
It's silent. Then the question is, why should the silence be interpreted as barring judicial review when they're the people who are hurt and the handlers are indifferent?
The analysis that the Supreme Court undertook in the Community Nutrition Institute case raised out several reasons that are equally applicable here. It frustrates the administrative scheme in instances...
How any more so than any other judicial review?
Because in this instance, there was a remedy available that was bypassed.
What
this
is that?
The dairy cooperatives...
No, that's the handler. They're not hurt in their handler capacity.
But, Your Honor, the statute and the regulations do not make the jurisdictional...
You keep repeating that, but they're hurt as producers, and I want a concrete reason why allowing them to sue as producers, forgetting their affiliation with handlers, is going to do some harm to the regulatory scheme.
The harm to the regulatory scheme is that these are disputes that are not subjected to the Ace Secretary's administrative review, opportunity to correct errors, opportunity to shape and build a record for judicial review. That is one harm. The harm in a case like
but
this...
But they, of course, argue that they weren't given notice. Now, suppose they weren't arguing about notice. They had other arguments in the district court. So those were arguments about, you know, being mistreated in various ways in the administrative process. Well, that is the usual way in which administrative cases come into court. Someone is complaining about administrative actions. Now he has to make those complaints to the secretary first, and then he can appeal.
And
so it's your argument that to exhaust their administrative remedies, they should have asked for reconsideration? Is that the problem?
They could have asked for reconsideration.
Suppose they asked and denied, and it had been denied, or that reconsideration had, and commission had, I mean, the Agriculture Department had can't come to the same conclusion. Could they then sue?
These plaintiffs could have sued, yes.
Not as handlers, as producers.
Right, Your Honor, I'm afraid I can't elaborate any further than I've already
done. Oh, yes, you can. Look, suppose they're just producers. They have no handler affiliation. They're denied notice, they think, they argue. So they go to the commission, they go to the department, they say, you didn't give us notice, and so on. And there's a proceeding on that. The department reconsiders and adheres to its view that it's the proper rule, then they would have exhausted their administrative remedies unequivocally. And is it your contention that even at that point they could not sue?
For most claims, there remains as in start a right of review if the allegation is that the agency has undertaken ultra vires action rather than a
challenge.
That's
not in any statute.
No, that is an extra
right.
statutory.
Okay. So now the question is, why shouldn't the extra statutory right of review extend to, you know, lack of substantial evidence, arbitrary
sure.
and capricious?
I think there are a number of reasons why that should not be so extended. First, the Starr case from which that right would emanate in this case makes clear that administrative challenges to the exercise of administrative discretion are not the type of actions that the court had in mind in sanctioning producer actions directly. The court was more was concerned solely whether characterized
something concrete.
Suppose
you want to argue. I mean, certainly the issue they present about notice is a conventionally justiciable due process type issue.
Yes.
So why is it that a court shouldn't be permitted to decide this issue, even if they've exhausted their administrative remedies?
Well, again, in addition to Stark, Your Honor, there is mandamus review in any instance which and there is a colorable allegation that the Secretary has violated a clear...
What if the argument is just that, you know, arbitrary and capricious?
Well, then, Your Honor, the court must turn to the rights of review that have been specified by Congress. And the question before
well,
the
then
court,
we're just back to this, you know,
yes,
construing
yes.
silence your way. You don't have a practical reason why this class of participants in administrative proceedings should be denied standing.
Now, there's certainly a split on this, right? There's certainly a split on this.
There's certainly a divergence of appellate authority, and there are differences in the... One could argue that there are factual differences.
Is your position at all that because under this regulatory scheme, producers get a unique benefit as members of this so-called competitive society, and they surrender something maybe because of that? I mean, is that one reason that they're not going to be allowed to participate in a judicial proceeding?
Your Honor, our arguments really are based on
what do you think Congress's intent was? Assuming you accept your position to exclude them. Is the policy that they've been somehow benefited unlike other producers in society, and therefore that unique benefits cost, it's going to cost something?
Well, at the risk of, again, repeating myself, Your Honor, the concerns that the Supreme Court referred to in CNI are equally applicable here. There is this is a statute that regulates handlers and Congress that subjects handlers to legal constraint. That's why Congress focused on judicial review for that class of people within the industry. The types of claims that rights that are claimed here are rights that are in the statute, rights to produce a referendum, rights of fair notice, again in the statute, but the statute is silent with respect to producer challenges to that. There is an administrative process required by statute. The Supreme Court has said repeatedly that it wants disputes of this character channeled to the Secretary first, so that the Secretary can apply his or her expertise. In CNI, the Court expressed particular concern with jurisdictional holdings that would prevent that administrative process to be bypassed. The Court took note in particular of the fact that handlers could qualify as consumers, and that if consumer rights of action, direct rights of action, were recognized directly, handlers would be able to bypass this process and go right into the courts without having the kind of administrative review that Congress contemplated. I realize these concerns don't satisfy you, Judge Posner, but they're the ones that the ones that the
Supreme Court has said. Do you have any view different than Ms. Reed on why handlers should be viewed more aligned with consumers than producers?
Yes, Your Honor. I think handlers would, and the Supreme Court kind of wrestled with this question in CNI as well. I mean, that was the case about whether the market structure unduly inflated the price of reconstituted milk. It made it more expensive for handlers to get access to, and more expensive for consumers to purchase in the marketplace. In theory, both handlers and consumers would have a similar interest in getting the lowest price possible at the source, but as the Court noted in the footnote, handlers can simply pass on the extra price to consumers, and their interest in that regard are not aligned in that way. But nonetheless, the Court said, because handlers could qualify as consumers, recognizing a direct right of action for consumers would have ramifications for handler rights of action that were inconsistent with how the Court read the statutory scheme. Thank you, Your Honor.
I didn't mean to cut you off. Did you have a
sweet... Well, I haven't had any time to address the notice question. If I could have one sentence, I would point the Court to one of the proposed rulemakings. It says 49 Federal Register 39884. It's in appended to the blue brief. It's the June 11th proceeding, and the Secretary noted that although he was going to go, the proposed order was going to go right to a producer referendum, parties would still have a right to petition for administrative address. The Secretary said the record clearly establishes the basis was noted above for amending the order on an interim basis, and the opportunity to file written exceptions to the proposed amended order remains. What that means is that interested parties could have asked the Secretary to reconsider.
Just one further question, if I could, Mr. Clare. To Mr. Vetney's point that in similarly situated situations, the notice has been more specific. Do you have any comment to his?
Well, I believe in an instance Mr. Vetney cited, there was a proposal from an interested, from a member of the industry to amend the order in a specific way and in a way analogous to the way the order was amended here. Those proposals are published. This proceeding also began as a petition from affected parties to amend the order. It had proposals to change the way in which milk that would qualify you for participation in the order's pricing scheme would be counted, but it did not have the proposals that the Secretary got did not have the specific language like this one. The order also makes the notice also makes clear that the Secretary was going to consider as need be modifications to those proposals at the hearing, and that's consistent with the notice of the APA requires of notice of the subjects and issues under consideration. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Bashore?
May it please the Court. My name is Marvin Bashore. I'm here to represent the more than 20,000 dairy farmer members of Dairy Farmers of America, Michigan Milk Producers Association, Perry Farms Dairy, and the National Farmers Organization, who were the farmers who requested that the Secretary of Agriculture hold this hearing, who marshaled the evidence, presented the testimony, formulated the proposals, defended the proposals, and were the moving parties in this entire process. We didn't get all we wanted, but we got a decision from the Secretary of Agriculture which substantially corrected the abuses of plugging some of the loopholes in the regulations for the Mideast marketing area, and we're here to defend, we intervened to defend the Secretary's actions in the proceeding, and we're here to ask that the court affirm Judge Griesbach's decision.
This business of these Wisconsin farmers being associated with Eastern handlers.
Association is a term that's used by us in the industry. It means they're pooled.
It means what?
They're pooled. They participate in the pool.
Well, what kind of relationship would the farmer have with this Eastern handler?
They could have a number of relationships. We appended to our brief a number of declarations that were filed in the lower court, including declarations by Wisconsin dairy farmers who are members of the organizations we represent, who are associated and pooled in this order before and after the Secretary's amendment. In several cases, they are associated and pooled because they deliver a portion of their milk production directly to a distributing plant in Cleveland or Indianapolis, Detroit, wherever it might be. They describe it, and if they deliver the requisite percentage from their farm in Wisconsin to the plants in the order, they're pooled, they're associated. Those are producer deliveries, producer milk deliveries. They're allowed, they were made more stringent by this order, but, you know, the tests are there, you meet them, you make them, you're associated. The association that was, the court association, that was addressed by the Secretary in the rule which has led to this litigation was the situation where farms in Wisconsin would deliver their milk to a supply plant some number of days a week and deliver their milk to a cheese manufacturing plant which might be right next door or even part of the same facility to a cheese manufacturing plant the rest of the time and have 100% of their production associated with the market, pooled in the market, and receive the blend price for all of their production. When you deliver or affiliate with a supply plant, as opposed to a distributing plant, which is the first scenario that I described, which is a fluid milk processing plant, when you deliver to a supply plant and are associated that way, the regulations impose obligations upon the supply plant, which is a handler. Supply plant's a handler. It may be operated by a cooperative, may be operated by a proprietary dairy firm, but it's a handler. The handler then has certain obligations if he, as a handler, is going to obtain the blend price in order to pass it through to the farmer supplying his plant. This particular regulation said the handler operating a supply plant may not qualify all the milk in his plant on the basis, if he's outside the market area, on the basis of deliveries of milk from farms that are down in Ohio that are just paper associated with his plant. I mean, they're not really suppliers to his supply plant. They're just on paper put on his report. That's what the Secretary outlawed here, but eliminated.
I understand, but I lost the thread. So you have a supply plant, and where is it located?
Supply plant can be located anywhere, but the ones that were associated, millions.
My concern was with these Wisconsin farmers delivering in, say, a Wisconsin cheese factory, but somehow they're associated with a handler in the east?
The supply plant, the regulations provide that supply plants, which historically were country milk assembly locations, which provided reserve supplies of milk to the fluid market, to the distributing plant. When they were short, in the fall of the season, when milk was short, or when there was a surge in demand, the supply plants would supply fluid milk to the distributing plants. And the Secretary of Agriculture, over a period of years, developed regulations and said, yes, if you're a supply plant, although you're a cheese manufacturer out in the country, and you provide a requisite portion of your total milk to the fluid plants in this market, your entire milk supply will be affiliated, associated, and pooled. Those are the supply plants. Now,
they get the blended price then.
they get the blend in.
No, for whatever reason, when you go to the cheese manufacturing, milk is lower priced.
That's right. But the pooling process, the blending process, is to provide to producers the blended price, irrespective of the use of their milk, if they perform sufficiently, or the supply plant to which they choose to
before this regulation, am I correct, that if this supply plant sold 3% of its, delivered 3% of its milk to the east, all of its milk was entitled to this blended price?
Yes, but there's a little more to the equation. It had to show on paper that in the months where deliveries were required, it had to show that 30% was delivered to distributing plants, but only 3% of that 30 had to come physically from the plant. So what had happened, the practice that we challenged from the very beginning of this hearing, the first witness, the second witness, the practice that had evolved was the plants in Wisconsin had identified, had signed up as the members of their supply organization, farmers down in Ohio who were delivering to the distributing plants, papered them.
They were delivering the 27%.
The 27% was being delivered from the farms down in Ohio and considered part of the supply plant supply, even though they were not.
So that's the associates. They were associated somehow.
They were associated on paper, on the report that the handlers filed with the market administrator, associated with that plant, and that made the 27%. The secretary said when this came out at the hearing, and by the way, the hearings, and this is a notice issue which I really wanted to focus on, these hearings are participatory, interactive, live processes. They're on-the-record proceedings presided over by an administrative law judge. There are objections which are ruled upon to the scope of the hearing notice, to the scope of the testimony. In this case, the plaintiff took what I would characterize, I think fairly, as a head-in-the-sand approach to the hearing, or a hear-no-evil, see-no-evil approach. They were there. They entered appearances, several of them. Mr. Vetney did not, as he told you. But three of the plaintiff cooperatives participated by entering appearances of officials or filing briefs after the hearing. They said nothing. They did not object when these issues were discussed in any way, that they were beyond the scope of the hearing notice. And by the way, the other proceedings which have been cited, the other agriculture proceedings where proposals have been determined to require more other hearings, or the secretary decided not to adopt them because they're beyond what he considered the scope of the hearing, people were there and objected, participated. These plaintiffs did not object to the testimony. They did not object to the modifications. Modifications always happen. These are interactive proceedings. The evidence comes in, and you react to the evidence. The evidence showed that some fine-tuning of these detailed proposals that we had worked on, in great detail, some fine-tuning was nevertheless required. We went up, our witnesses testified to this fine-tuning. No one objected. And the testimony went in, and the secretary addressed it and said, this is what is required.
Those producers that you say were in attendance, they just were, they were in what role? Just the spectators?
They entered appearances, formal appearances on the record on behalf of Land O'Lakes and Midwest Dairy.
And they had an opportunity to?
They had an opportunity, and in fact they did question witnesses. The representative Land O'Lakes questioned, our witnesses. And they had an opportunity to object, and they did not object.
Just a little question of detail. There was something about producers have to approve, the two-thirds of the producers have to approve.
Yes.
Is this one producer, one vote, or is it weighted by their output?
It's essentially one producer, one vote, although there's a sort of a bifurcated ratio that can be done. The vote is just on all or nothing on the order as far as that's concerned. You got to vote for the order as amended or nothing at all, so that it's not a line.
So is that after the commission's?
Yes. Order, after the
then there's a vote by the producers. Right.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Bedney, you may have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I wanted to make one point in response to government counsel
I think it was an inaccurate description of the administrative process where there is a handler that complains in a 15A petition, and that is that the process develops the record. In a proceeding such as this, where there is a formal notice, a formal hearing with a transcript, exhibits, cross-examination, the courts and the secretary have both ruled that that is the only record that is relevant for purposes of testing the secretary's rule. There is no additional information, no additional facts that can be presented because the hearings are timed to do it. Your Honor, concerning the question asked and the point made about the other proceeding in which this was specifically noticed, and it was an industry proposal and the same folks. It does not matter, at least for purposes of this court and the D.C. court, D.C. Circuit's analysis, that somebody in the public noticed something or commented. Notice it must come at all from the agency. And the adequacy of notice must be measured by the notice published, not by something that happens in comment or at the hearing. There are two steps here.
Mr. Bayshore made a good point, didn't he, that you don't start a legal proceeding by announcing what the relief is going to be. So as the proceeding proceeds, everyone knew that paper pooling was the issue, didn't they?
I don't believe that the nature of the way it's described, we knew it was an issue or could have known it was an issue because of the similarity of the proposal in the central market, number one. And number two, we couldn't have known that paper pooling would continue to be allowed for a Muskegon plant with associated producers in Pittsburgh, but not for a nearby Illinois or Wisconsin plant with delivering to Indiana.
I can't imagine that's the focus of your concern. Surely your people were worried that if paper pooling was abolished or greatly curtailed, that would be a harm to your clients.
Your Honor, specifically, the no proposal that came at the hearing, we believe, was beyond the scope of the notice that was published by USDA. USDA could have issued a supplemental notice. The rule that was adopted by the Secretary was beyond the scope of the testimony at the hearing as well as the notice. It's one of these second cousins. You move from a proposal to generality and back to a new proposal discussed in a fertilizer case. If the rule had been adopted that were proposed at the hearing, which we contest was beyond, and if testimony were presented, we could have still shipped milk from farms in Wisconsin around the Chief plant, something that we have to do but not the Muskegon plant, and ship that milk to our distributing plant customers. That would have, I think, addressed what you perceive to be the concern, is that the milk really ought to come from Wisconsin to be shipped to Indianapolis if it's going to associate with this market. But that wasn't what was adopted. We could not have foreseen that milk coming directly from farms to Indianapolis from Wisconsin farms by diversion, that the rule would be, no, you can't even do that. You have to take that Wisconsin milk, pump it into your plant, pump it out, and then send it. And the Secretary has rejected that pump-in, pump-out over the course of 20 years because it deteriorates quality, it's inefficient because of shrinkage. It's like going to a car safety rulemaking and
You're saying that 30% has to be sent to a supply plant, it can't be sent to the ultimate customer?
The 30% is a requirement of the volume of milk that you're responsible for, the volume of farms. It's the volume that has to go to a distributing plant. The 30%.
Does it have to go to a supply plant?
No, it's a percentage of what is pulled by the supply plant. It doesn't have to touch the supply plant. The 30%...
And what's your concern about the pumping in and pumping out?
Oh, because that's the rule that was adopted. The 30% now for a supply plant, and by the way, none of the four supply plants that were in the market in July of last year are currently on the market. They're off because this is so burdensome. The rule here is that the milk, the only way to qualify this milk through Wisconsin supply plants as opposed to Michigan supply plants, is it has to go from the farm. You bring it to the supply plant, you pump it into the supply plant, then you pump it back onto a truck, and then you can take that truck and ship it to your ultimate customer. You may not, under this rule, take the milk directly from a Wisconsin farm to an Indianapolis buyer and count it as
as qualifying for purposes of supplying the fluid market. We could not have seen a result that is as old as horse and buggy being resurrected in the final rule here, even with the proposal that was advanced at the hearing, nor could we marshal evidence or evidence or experts to oppose it at the hearing. And in fact, the opportunity for exceptions that the Council for Government noticed, exceptions had been filed, and some of our clients filed exceptions a long time ago. There is still no final order. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Bettany. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.